This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 Joycast. In this Joycast, you'll hear a summary of the weekly program. Due to copyright restrictions, the music has been edited to make this Joycast possible. For more information about the music played during the show, please visit the blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera.
Good evening and welcome to another episode of The Fool and the Opera. I'm your regular host, Dan Vo, and today I'll be joined in the studio by a few special guests because, they are very special to me. In one corner, we've got Jed Gilbert, our audio producer.
Hi, Dan. How are you going?
Good, thank you. And in the other corner, we've got Byron.
Thanks for having me here, Dan.
Now, Byron is a regular on the casting couch.
Yes.
And also, you're currently studying The Taste of Radio as well.
I am, yes. Sort of wanting to get to know how it all comes together rather than just brushing in and doing my little bit that I normally do.
So you've got some music that we'll play a little bit later as well.
Yes, very excited.
Because you're from the movie program, there might be a bit of a
theme. There's a bit of a movie theme, but we'll get to that when we play the pieces.
Great. And Jed, you're just a bit of a media whore. Cause,
yes, jumping from studio to studio, it seems. But I was very privileged to go to AIDA with you, with Dan, and so we'll be talking a bit about that.
Yep, absolutely. I might just explain. Jed also does a few things at Bent TV, so...
Yes, Monday nights at 10:30, Channel 31. Just a little plug there. Gay Newsweek. It's comical. Tune in. I promise you it's funny.
It certainly is, because you're on it and I occasionally appear on it.
I'm not the funny one, though. I'm like the fact inserter. And yes, other people are funny.
Well, hopefully tonight you'll be able to insert some facts as well.
Okay.
Now, the theme for today's show will be 6 feet under the clap and 2D or not 2D.
Dan, and your triptychs, because that is too complicated.
Well, that's the whole thing. It will make sense throughout the show.
Does it, though?
Hopefully.
I would actually like to ask people to message in, and if you're a regular listener to this show, message in to 0427-JOY-949 or email onair@joy.org.au, or you can call 9699-2949, because if you're a regular listening to this show, I would actually like to know if you pick up Dan's triptych every show, which is his little three theme.
It's a trio of cryptic clues.
There you go. But, and I, because I do the podcast, I pick up on them each week and pop them on the little description of the podcast. And even I am still guessing by the end of the show what it means. And sometimes they're so like complicated with alliteration and like all these hidden meanings. So I'd like you to explain it more clearly, please.
Okay. Well, today, 2D or not 2D, we'll explain when we talk about the set of AIDA, I think.
2D and okay.
Yeah.
You'll have to explain that one.
Two-dimensional. But we'll get
ah, like 2D.
Yeah.
Ah, see?
Have you seen the AIDA yet? The
recent one? No. No, I think the last time I saw AIDA was in 1988 in Bris Vegas.
Lovely. Well, there's also some latest movie news about AIDA as well, isn't there?
Yes, I think I heard a vicious rumour that Disney are looking at doing AIDA with none other than Beyoncé Knowles in there somewhere. World. Yes. Yep.
That'd be cool. That's like the ultimate single lady. She'd be doing the whole dance. It'd be awesome.
It'll be like the Egyptian version of the single lady dance.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, she'll have to walk like an Egyptian as well.
An Elizabeth Taylor eye makeup, Cleopatra.
So to open up, because we always like to start the show with a bit of a strange track, we've picked, now Jed, you got to pick the group, because we went through and got Elton John and Tim Rice's Aida, which is a musical.
Yes.
And you picked the group that we'd play today. And who are they?
Spice Girls, of course.
So we're expecting you to do the dance during the...
Which one's that? I'll be posh.
Well, this is My Strongest Suit off the musical Aida. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9, and we are talking about things Aida today, but we'll also delve a little bit into music as well, because we've got two special guests in the studio, regular audio producer Jed Gilbert, and we've also got Byron, who's one of our Taste of Radio graduates. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Dan.
So, did you enjoy that little...
I like the group. I probably should have asked to hear the track before choosing that track. So, it's the musical that... Elton John and Tim Rice wrote that tracks the story of Aida.
That's right.
But in a musical format, like non-opera.
That's right.
So what does underwear have to do with Aida?
And overwear. Well, apparently this song's all about the princess, Amneris, and she's so obsessive about fashion and clothes that that's why Radames doesn't like her.
Oh, my God. Well, that's...
And falls for Aida instead.
Far be it from me to... question the genius of Tim Rice and Elton John, but I am not getting that one. But should we explain Aida?
I think you
should. For all those beginners out there.
Yeah, because you were brand new to the opera, weren't you?
Yeah, I'd never seen it before. I remember it came to Perth when I lived there for a little bit when I was younger, and it was on the foreshore and it was outside and it looked all awesome and I never went. So I was very excited to go. And it was choreographed by Graham Murphy, so I was very excited to see it. So... Aida is a slave girl from Ethiopia, and the opera is set in Egypt with the king and the leader of the army, basically. And the leader of the army loves this slave girl, Aida, and Aida loves him back, but the king's daughter, Amneris, I don't know how to pronounce that, Amneris, she loves Ramesses, and they... Radames. That's the one. And they want to... Basically, she wants to break Aida and Radames up, and then the story continues.
So, the thing about the show is, I suppose why it was on the foreshore in Perth was because usually there's a huge sort of triumphant march where all these amazing creatures and, you know, treasure chests full of gold and that sort of thing appear. And I know that, Byron, you're aware of a show that's about to happen in France.
Yeah, I'm on an email list for a lot of things that happen at Stade de France, a big stadium in Paris. And I received an email the other day saying next year they're doing Aida in this stadium. Now, there was a recent concert series there that had 80,000 people each night. So it's quite a huge venue.
And would you be able to see anything? They have
big screens and those binocular things that people always have trouble flipping over.
The Jumbotron at the opera.
Yeah.
Be cool.
Well, and it usually is quite a big production, and our state theatre seems to be quite small.
It's not, though, Dan. Like, it's actually an enormous theatre. Like, it's an enormous stage for world standards. And I have that on good authority from my mum. And it's actually quite a big stage. So the fact, like... we were talking about this before, that it looked a bit squashed with 80 people on stage. But that's actually quite a large stage.
But I think that will probably be the point of it, to make it look like there's just so much happening on stage. And they did it very cleverly with this particular production as well, by having these two-dimensional sort of images that would slide across the screen. Like it was like the production was inspired in an airport and you've just got these conveyor belts.
Well, there were conveyor belts down the front, but I don't know if it was inspired by an airport. I thought there were two conveyor belts down the front. Well, we should explain the stage. There was water down the front, which represented the Nile. well. And it was kind of used in an interactive way throughout it. And see, sometimes they put a boat on one of the conveyor belts and the boat went along the water and it worked quite well. And other times they had hieroglyphics. So help me.
Hieroglyphics? No, I'm not going to be able
to. Everyone knows what we're trying to say.
Thank you.
Thank you. And that they were moving along the conveyor belts and looked, and it was interspersed between, you know, pictures and actual humans standing there. You know how they have humans in the hieroglyphics? That word. Mm-hmm. And they that worked really well. But there were other times when the opera singers were just standing on the conveyor belts and then they'd start moving like across the stage and it would be a bit strange. And I'm surprised that it didn't affect their singing, actually.
Well, I'm sure they're, you know, used to kind of having a good bass, and they always say that a pyramid is the best sort of shape for good solid grounding. So
well, there was a pyramid at the back.
There was. In fact, that was the thing about the particular set that I really liked, was it was a very simple set and there was just one big white triangle on that floated in on a flat, and also a triangle on the ground, and they used it quite effectively when there was the love triangle duet. You know, they actually stood on each point of the triangle and you're like, oh, it's a love triangle.
But you know, you say it's a simple set, but I actually think it was quite complicated. It was raised on a diagonal with a trap door through it, and a lot of fly-ins. And I was actually confused because they do it one night and then they're not on for a week and then they're on again. But apparently at the State Theatre, there's like a whole nother stage behind the actual stage where they can just move everything out there temporarily. And so then do the other performances they're doing and then just slide it all back in, apparently.
Oh, it kind of is. Yeah, it's a little bit trickier than that. Yeah. It's not as simple as that. But yeah, you're right. They do fly in operas after opera.
Because that's an enormous set to fly in for one night.
It is, but they're just so effective at doing it now. They can, I think, you know, the techies like to time themselves and actually get it under a certain time and get it better each time. So, yeah, they're very good at what they do. And I suppose the thing that was interesting about it as well is also that it had a lot of projections as well. So they used the very white pyramid and then they projected different images.
Yeah, which kind of reflected the mood as well of each piece, which... I guess it's pretty hard to bring a spectacular, like, you know, you're saying with camels and everything like that into a stage and still keep it exciting. So they tried to use, I think, a lot of tricks, I guess. And it was kind of quite modern with the way that they used projections and as you're saying, 2D structures that flied in and out and picked up the projections. I think it was quite clever.
Yeah. The last time they had an animal in the State Theatre was for Carmen, and it was a horse. And it got a huge applause at the end because it had done its business on stage.
Well, you don't want a camel in there.
Or elephants or giraffes or zebras for that matter.
I don't think so.
So, in terms of the dancing in it, because it is Graham Murphy and he's a very renowned dance choreographer.
Yep.
What did you think of the different set dance pieces?
Well, I am not entirely sure, but I think that he did more than just the dancing in the production. So I think all of it goes, well, not all of it, but, you know, a large proportion of it goes to Graham. And I thought the dancing, yeah, some of it was really interesting. There was some really interesting choreography. I guess for me, I just find it, because I was raised with my mom being a contemporary dancer, and their companies really struggle with maybe like 15 dancers, and then opera, you have 80 people who are being paid to stand on the stage and not like actually do that much, and somehow they're getting funded to do that. So I realize I'm on an opera show and I'm probably gonna get killed, but for something that for other companies in the arts like contemporary dance, where they're having to be quite frugal, and every dancer is used as much as possible, to have some people playing trumpet, like, going along the front, I don't know.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing about us three. Now, you're coming from the dance aspect, I'm coming from the opera aspect, and you've got, the independent Australian films and that sort of thing as well.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all very strapped for cash, and it all seems to go to sports and that sort of thing. I mean...
Well, does it? Because I think a lot of arts people, would say a lot of it goes to opera. Like, opera is very well funded.
Well, in opera's defense, it is the mother of all arts. Like, it incorporates.
It's expensive to stage.
Yeah, absolutely. And it incorporates things like dance and film, the projections, and also, you know, the singing as well, which, you know, takes years of training.
But does it require the 80th person on the stage?
What do you think, Byron? 79 singers versus 80 singers.
Oh, go to 79. It's all part of the spectacle.
I guess I'm just an outsider looking at it from another spectrum of the arts, which doesn't receive as much funding. But, you know, I guess the 80 people make a difference somehow.
There was extra bling on stage.
Yeah, and they're getting to follow their passion, so that's awesome. What? How about 80 dances for all the contemporary dance people? There you go.
I must admit, though, the interesting thing about opera singers is their movement isn't as refined as the dancers. And wow. It was interesting to see them sort of walking across the stage and they're just all slightly out of sync with each other. But their musical timing in terms of their singing was spot on. So.
Yeah, well, I don't think you're asking the dancers to sing opera, so you have to cut them some slack.
Okay, so now I'm going to play a track now. It's the final duet. And you were quite surprised by the duet at the end, weren't you?
I was, but I don't know if it's wrecking it for people who haven't seen it. But the interval ends with a fantastic finale, big triumphant chorus, and it's very exciting. And then they actually did a curtain call on the interval. So everyone came out, including all the chorus, and they all bowed. And I was like, is that the ending? What the hell? And then I've never seen that done before in the interval. But then I guess it's because at the end, it ends on a complete downer. And they're just like, there's
six
no...
6 feet downer.
Yeah. Yes, quite. And they're just, I mean, it's kind of, it makes you think, I guess, a bit more and be reflective. But yeah, it doesn't end on a fanfare. It ends on a very, very quiet piece.
Mm. And in saying duet, there's actually a third person as well. The princess comes in to say the final words, which is Pache.
Pache, which is, I know from my Spanish, means peace.
Well, this is the final aria from Aida. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. We're here with Dan Bowe, the regular host. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Can you say The Fool and the Opera again?
The Fool and the Opera.
Yeah. I usually use your voice for the stage in between.
Yeah. And Byron from Taste of Radio and The Casting Couch.
Yes. Hello.
And we're talking about Aida.
We are. And there was an interesting thing that you brought up, which I really don't know the answer for this one. It was to do with the clap.
Oh, well, not that clap, but clapping, Dan. Clapping. I was just wondering because there was one point where the scene ended and the music ended and no one clapped. And like the Amnesis, the woman, had done a very good job and I wanted to clap. And it's happened a couple of times when we've gone to opera before, Dan, and I haven't, like, I've gone to clap and no one's clapped and I'm like, why aren't they applauding?
Yeah, usually Jed just turns to me, looks incensed, going, why is no one clapping?
I know, I do. With my hands, like, poised to make the clap.
Byron, you've been to a few operas, have you?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. It's like, I think it's with opera specifically, and even, say, a classical musical performance, it is the end of the acts, and I suppose you're supposed to have sort of gone through your program guide beforehand and go, okay, so that's not the end of the act. Well, okay, now I clap here. And I think that's what it is. That's what I seem to recall.
Mm. Yeah, and there are some times where one person starts clapping, and normally it would catch on, you know, in other performances, but yeah. Everyone's like, no, you should not be clapping.
I was going to say, all the opera snobs are sitting there going, first timer. Yeah,
it's true.
But the other thing is, I think that's a very Melbourne-specific thing as well, because in Sydney, I hear that there's a lot of standing ovations. In Melbourne, I've not seen many.
I've been surprised that at the end of everything we've gone to, there hasn't been a standing ovation.
And then the other thing is, in places like Italy, they'll applaud the end of everything. And if it's really good, they'll make the person sing it again. Or if it's really bad, they'll make the person sing it again. So, yeah.
Like booing them until they do it again.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
So allegedly there was a tenor who got booed so much that he just walked off stage, and that was it. Roberto Alagna, I think was his name, and he stormed off, and it's on YouTube. It's actually quite fun.
Really?
To see. Yeah, he's just got this look on his face. It's like, damn you, Italy.
I have to check it out.
Yeah.
So yeah, we'll have to do some more research into that and go to different cities and see if it's different as well. Because I hear from different performers that Melbourne tends to be very short and sharp. They sort of clap, applaud, that's it, go home.
Yeah.
I find Melbourne like that in a lot of things, not just in the arts as well. Like exercise classes at the gym in Auckland, everyone's involved and yahooing and everything like that. Whereas here, everyone's quiet. It's like everyone's obviously working so hard they can't make a sound.
Or everyone's, I don't know. But I also wanted to talk about the speed of the plot in Aida, because it's a 19th century opera, and it was very different to ones that we've seen that were made earlier than that. It was much pacier. Mm. The scenes were quicker, the storyline progressed more quickly. And you were talking about the opera that you saw in Brisbane, that's a recent one by young people, and each scene,
I think it's 38 scenes, and the maximum timing for any scene was 2.5 minutes. Two minutes and 38 seconds was the longest scene that they had.
And so what I wanted to ask you is that true? Has there been a progression from kind of languid, kind of slow-moving pieces to something where it's... Has there been a steady progression through time where it's gotten more snappier?
I think so. I think that because the one that you're comparing against was Handel, and I can't remember what...
Adrian Afnaxos, I think.
Oh, no, that was Strauss. But that was a 19th century one. No, that was a 20th... Anyway.
I see you're confusing me.
I'm very confused now as well. But we saw a Handel one at Melbourne Recital Centre.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, the music tends to repeat itself, you know, several times in the one aria, and it's very slow moving, you're right. And whereas this one was a lot snappier. It was like 1871 when Aida was made, but and I think that that's where things kind of ended up, because we were talking about Turandot before, Puccini, who's kind of successor to Verdi. Like, he's was very snappy, and every moment there was drama, and it just kind of just flows like a great story. Up until where now, you know, it's mostly musicals are the thing that hold your attention, and it's because it's very fast.
And, well, I mean, I think for me, this is stupid, this is going to sound really amateur, but I have like a classic 100 classical music CD, and it includes recent classical music from like films.
Yeah.
So it has like Raiders of the Lost Ark and Star Wars and that kind of things. And it's funny hearing that in the context of classical music. And whether there has been like a progression over time of it becoming snappier and more attention engaging, because in a way film is the natural successor of opera in a way.
Yeah.
Over time.
I hadn't thought of it that way.
Well, I'd say that Star Wars 4, 5, and 6 is a lot slower than Star Wars 1, 2, 3.
And they were made earlier, yeah, so
that's right. Even though presented, that time warp confuses me. But yeah, in the more modern Star Wars, you always find there's always the sequence with those little those race pods just chucked in, because you know it needed some bang in there to keep the attention.
And I think, you know, it makes sense, because back then, you know, 200 years ago, the only bit of real entertainment you would have seen maybe would have been 1 or 2 times a week if you weren't laughing at your friend or some kids or something. But nowadays we have entertainment coming at us all the time. So obviously our attention span is going to be less forgiving. Don't you think?
I'd say, I don't know. The thing that I really do like about opera is the fact that it is like a great orgasm. It's a slow build, and then it peaks at the very end after a few hours.
What were you saying about the clap, Dan?
What were you saying about culture? Let's move on.
Well, anyway, in my grand triptych attempt to come up with a theme for the show, I was going towards Aida and Gaga. I hadn't got the third one yet. But isn't that kind of the natural progression to Lady Gaga, where there's 3-minute songs, they're completely snappy, and if you look at her latest film clip called Bad Romance, like, it looks like an opera, but all mashed together with 15 things going on at once. Mm.
And to qualify this, Lady Gaga has also come out and said that she wants to make an electro-pop opera CD as well.
There you go. It's all got to be viewed in context.
Well,
that'd be the next step on from the lights of Emma Chaplin, wouldn't it?
I've got a bit of Emma Chaplin here. We can play if you like. Let's pick up on the culture bit, because you had a few questions about Egyptian culture as well, didn't you?
Well, yeah, I think also it's always fun to see Aida because it's so glamorous, like all the glam kind of costumes, and it's sparkly.
Lots
of
gold.
Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, I guess it's just it kind of transports you back to a different time where you start to get a glimpse of a completely different culture that existed 25 or 3,000 years ago or more. And it's a completely different culture and language and everything that as far as I understand, we still don't understand a lot of it. And yet to them, it was completely accepted. Mm. It was how they were raised and how they understood everything, how they saw the world with their Egyptian gods, with Isis, and just a completely different way of seeing the world.
Mm. Also remembering that it's a 19th century take on what they thought.
True.
Of what 19th century people thought, or in Italy thought, was happening in Egypt back then as well.
True. Yeah, it's an Italian's take on Egyptian culture.
And then it's a, you know, a Graham Murphy take on... on what it is. So it's you're right, it is very interesting to sort of see the costumes, which, you know, some of the things that we're so used to seeing, those Elizabethan costumes for Shakespeare plays and that sort of thing, and this is something a little bit different and very exciting. More bling, as you were saying.
Yeah.
Definitely more bling. But I also found in terms of one criticism I'd have, and I hate criticizing Verdi because, my god, but like all it was about fate. Like, the whole opera was about fate. And, you know, like Shakespeare, it's like, it's chance, or is it fate, or is it chance? And he leaves, it's so intricately woven, you never know quite which one it is. And it leaves you questioning, and it's like real life. Whereas Verdi, it's all like, fate is the answer. Everything's about fate.
We should take him to some Verdi Shakespeare operas. To see if he has able to weave all that in.
All right.
But the other interesting thing about, I suppose, a Graham Murphy take on things is there was, of course, the Graham Murphy take on Turandot, which is very, you know, Chinese, and it's Chinese princess, the imperial city, and it's very beautiful. There's a film coming up very soon as well.
Yeah, the Met from New York, the HD series, is going to be shown at the Cinema Nova, so that would be quite spectacular. I unfortunately can't go because I have to work, but I understand you're going along, Dan.
Yes, I was so excited I peed my pants. It's a huge set, and it looks like an imperial city. There's running water, there's streams, fountains, and all these temples, and people walk in and out of the stage on these huge bridges, and to see that, it's just the most amazing not only set, but also the music is just absolutely gorgeous, and you know, it has all that drama that just keeps on pounding at you, and it keeps your attention. So,
and do you clap at the end, or it's because they're not really there, you're clapping a film?
No, when I've been to the HD ones, and usually people are all clapping in there at the end.
Are they psychotic? Do they understand the concept?
I think they all clap because you actually see everyone or you hear everyone in the audience clapping as well.
Oh, okay.
On the actual
transmission. So it's like guinea pigs. When you hear other people clapping, you just start clapping. But actually, we went and saw an HD filming for
Madame Butterfly?
Yes. And in the interval, they had a thing that counted down.
Yeah.
But they also had an interview with the singer. And they had the end, like they talked about the ending of the opera in the interview, which was at interval. And so I guess they assume that everyone already knows the story and has been before. But I'm sitting there going, you just wrecked the ending.
Yeah, no, was this a blonde-haired woman that was doing the interview? Because they did the same thing when I went and saw La Rondana.
Oh.
And they sort of gave it away at the end, and I'd never actually seen La Rondana.
Ah, seriously?
It's usually Renee Fleming who does it, and she's a wonderful opera singer in her own right. But yeah, it does ruin it, the story a bit. I remember the look of shock on your face when you were like, oh, she dies!
Yes.
Now, there's another little performance that I wanted to applaud it as well. It was in a Luc Besson film.
Ah, yes.
Yes, do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
Yes, so it's the it's the Fifth Element, and they're at the planet Floston on this big sort of floating cruise ship, and there's an operatic diva from some other planet who has actually hidden these secret stones which are going to save the world within herself. And as part of the performance, she actually performs a piece from Lucia de Lammermoor, the Donizetti opera. We've actually got that music here today. So it's actually in two parts. You hear the operatic piece, and then it gets quite sort of dance music up, pop rock popped up a bit at the end. So it's Lucia de Lammermoor / the Diva Dance.
I actually love this track, and I saw it when I was a kid, and I loved it so much. I went out and bought the Fifth Element CD for my dad as a Father's Day present because I liked it. Obviously, he must like it. And I couldn't work out if it was for real or not, like her voice.
It's someone by the name of Inva Mulacharko.
But is it? See what you think.
Well, I'm going to also dedicate this one to Jo Curtin because she requested this one a few weeks ago. So okay, I'm very glad we get to play it now. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. We're having a very robust discussion at the moment.
You just caught us arguing. I'm sorry, but that is spliced together.
No, she really sang those notes.
She may have sung those notes, but not in that time frame and in that sequence.
No, the original was sung and all done, and then the effect was placed later. So what that you hear is actually possible if you just didn't have those weird effects.
No, it goes from literally whatever it is, it goes from a C to a D with electronic precision. There's no way that she could have done that with her voice. And in the film, she has five throats, five larynxes to make the sound. That's the whole point.
You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. This is Dan Vo here, and Byron is my guest on the show today. What do you think, Byron?
I'm going to sit on the fence and just...
You can't be Switzerland.
I just love the piece of music. That's all that I need to know.
No, I do love it. I love the piece of music, but it is spliced together.
My apologies to Mark, who's listening and was having a very relaxing listen just before. He says, "Hi, guys. Great show. I'm relaxing in the bath after a long bike ride, enjoying the listening." And also, he'd like to say to Jed and I, congrats on the CBAA nomination.
Thank you, Mark, although it mainly goes to Dan. Congratulations, Dan.
Well, the piece that we got nominated for was the audio production piece that we worked on together for the Melbourne Recital Centre tour, so it goes to both of us.
Well, you did the interviews and everything.
All right, let's stop blowing smoke up each other's.
Yeah, but do you want to explain it? It was the awards for the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia.
That's right, yes. And I suppose the greatest honour that any community broadcaster can get. So we're very humbled to be nominated. It's lovely to just be nominated.
Yeah, it's shortlisted. We haven't won it yet.
That's right. And it's in the area of contribution to youth. Contribution by youth. So that's a lovely little thing to have an opera show, you know.
Yeah, I think I saw in your blog that it still counts. Even though it's the Youth Award, it still counts.
That's right. So, yeah, that's where we're at. And we're here talking with Byron a little bit about... we've only got a few short minutes left, so maybe we'll play this this other little track that you've brought in for us, which is from another movie as well, I understand.
Yeah, it's from another movie. The running with the whole diva theme, the actual film was a French film from 1970 or 1971 called Diva, and I've seen it once. I can't even remember the context that this operatic piece was in, but I just remember hearing it and thinking, I really like that. The piece is from an opera called La Wally, or La Volley, I'm not sure how you say it, but it's Eben Neandro Lontano.
Okay. I've got a book at home that's from Italy that's very similar. It's called Dove La Volley.
But you know, it has my...
Is that like the one that I've got, Ue Wally?
Where's Wally?
I don't... Oh, okay. See, you have to explain these things. But actually, it has my nephew's name in this song title, Eben. Oh. So can we dedicate this to my nephew?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
All right, so we'll play this. You're on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. on The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9. Stirring music there. A wonderful piece.
It was. Beautiful piece. And yes, good, like, timing with the ending.
Thank you.
I do the podcast, so I noticed this stuff.
And for Jed's sake, where's Wally in Spanish is?
¿Dónde es el Waldo?
There you go.
I didn't, yeah, get that. But can you explain the triptych now? Because I still, you did the 2D, 2D or
2D
not.
2D or not 2D.
See, I can't even do it.
Because, of course, and on Aida, they had all the two-dimensional people slide across and the pictures of the gods and that sort of thing.
All right, I understand that clue now from your title.
You get the clap thing.
The clap, yeah.
Yes.
I get that one.
And 6 feet under would be the tomb. They get entombed, so they're 6 feet
under. We didn't really discuss that, though. How are people supposed to get that?
I slotted it in somewhere. I said 6 feet down or something when you're talking about entombment. We've got a vague yes.
Yeah,
you did.
The audience there.
Okay, do we have the adjudicator come in and say you did? But can you add that in as a regular explanation?
Yes,
for the clue, because it's so clever, Dan, and people don't get it. I don't get it.
Thank you, Jed. Now, we've got some last-second SMSs that have come in. Would you like to read them?
Hi to my sister. She said, well done, congrats, that's great, I think, regarding the award. So, thank you, Katriana.
Mm-hmm.
And just caught the last 20 minutes. Great show, guys. Good content and music. Thank you, Paul.
Yes, and we'll be on air next week. Paul will be on the show, so he'll be filling in the reins as we fly up to Queensland and see if we do get that award or not.
So, fantastic.
Mm, we'll call in and let you know next week. But coming up is Andy Mack with a wonderful night of fantastic jazz. He's got an extra special first track. And, well, as I suppose, who are we going to pick today? Who was the last singer? As Where's Wally? As Wally.
As Waldo would say.
I'll catch you next week. Same Fledermaus time, same Fledermaus channel. This has been The Fool and the Opera on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to the Joycast of The Fool and the Opera from Joy 94.9. You can find more Joycasts and the program blog at joy.org.au/The Fool and the Opera. The Fool and the Opera is produced by Dan Vo and Jed Gilbert. Thanks to the support of Joy sponsors and members. Please help support it by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.